This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bella, 20th Century History Guy. Thirty-two years ago, a newly elected president took to the airwaves for his first televised address to the nation. It was the dead of winter, and a very cold winter at that, and there were oil and natural gas shortages. And so Jimmy Carter, clad in that now famous cardigan, got right down to business.
I realize that many of you have not believed that we really have an energy problem, but this winter has made all of us realize that we have to act. I know that we can meet this energy challenge if the burden is borne fairly among all our people. All of us and if we realize, must learn to waste less energy. Simply by keeping our thermostats, for instance, at 65 degrees in the daytime and 55 degrees at night, we could save half the current shortage of natural gas.
Later that year, President Carter set up the Department of Energy and charged it with developing a comprehensive energy plan that would reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
This difficult effort will be the moral equivalent of war, except that we will be uniting our efforts to build and not to destroy.
Three decades later, we're using 30% more energy than we did back then and importing 50% more oil. But, you know, maybe we're on the brink of a change. I don't know what you think, guys, but energy independence was a major issue in the recent election, and I have a feeling something might be changing because for the first time, we have an actual scientist who's been named to head up the Energy Department. He's a person that's very committed to renewable energy technologies.
Each week on Backstory, we pick a topic from the news and spend an hour exploring its history. And we got a big one this week, and the topic, of course, is energy. How did we used to think about fuel consumption? When did the question of scarcity first emerge? When it comes to the search for new energy technologies, have we ever been eager to embrace change? And why should we think that we would be now? And maybe the biggest question of all is, how did we get to be such energy pigs?
Well, you know, Peter, I liked all the questions up to that last one, but that last one really points the finger at the 20th century, right? People are always citing that statistic about how we're less than 5% of the world's population, but we consume almost a quarter of its energy resources today.
Picky, picky, picky.
Yeah. Well, look, I have a sneaking suspicion that maybe we got greedy back in Ed's period. Wake up, Ed. I'm pointing the finger. That's right. Energy yep. hogs. Energy
come on,
hogs.
Come on. It didn't matter then. And 19th century people knew it didn't matter.
Well, fortunately.
We had more trees than we could possibly cut down.
Yeah, come on.
Fortunately, I was able to ask a real expert that question.
I hate it when you do that.
His name is David Nye, and he's a professor at the University of Southern Denmark. He's written extensively about Americans' history with energy. Here's what David told me.
Well, I would say that this is happening by the middle of the 19th century as the country expands very rapidly and starts to build long railways that go, you know, clear across the country. And whereas if you go back to the colonial period, you'd mm-hmm. probably say, well, yes, they may have burned a little more wood because they had more trees, but the whole society wasn't living on a different energy plane in a sense. They were pretty much on the same level as other societies.
And were people calling us out for that then? I mean, Tocqueville noticed everything else. Did he notice this?
I can't recall a passage where
yeah,
he talks
I can't
about
either.
It. No.
Did anybody no, I, notice, David, or this kind
well,
of just happened imperceptibly?
I think it's not a thing that happens in any one year. It just kind of gradually accelerates like a snowball rolling that picks up more and more snow. But it was also something celebrated, even as late as the 1950s. People thought, well, if you're using more energy, it's because you're more advanced. I mean, there was even a theory of anthropology. Leslie White, one of the leading anthropologists back in the 1950s and 60s, he classified cultures in terms of their amount of energy that they used. And the most advanced cultures, of course, were the ones used the most.
So given that attitude and our retrospectively, we look back and say, gee, we wring our hands. How do we become such energy hogs? What are the two things you want the new Secretary of Energy to really keep in mind?
Only two.
This is radio. I'm only giving you a choice of two.
Only two.
Yeah. What are the two things that you have learned from history that we can apply right now that's going to make a difference in the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, one thing is that the consumers drive an awful lot of change. So that if you think you're going to get change by investing in R&D and getting people to invent something, and then the change will come, my sense is an awful lot of things are already here that could save us huge amounts of energy. I'd probably start with the most simple and obvious thing, the light bulb.
Uh-huh.
And the next obvious thing would be insulation. Not all houses are very well insulated.
So rather than reinventing the wheel, look at wheels that have recently been invented and see how we can get millions of people to use them.
That would be my first thing. And also get the consumer involved as an active player.
Uh-huh.
Because that will tend to drive innovation in itself.
And can you think of any historical instances where, here's an idea, you're the expert, but would rural electrification be a good example of that during the New Deal?
Yeah, that is an interesting example because in that case, there were lots of people who wanted electricity.
Right.
But they didn't have a way to get it because they were too far away. So the government helped out in a sense that they helped people providing a legal mechanism. In a sense, you could form a cooperative.
Right.
And you could borrow money. And most of those loans were paid back, by the way. It turned out to be not a bad investment. The money came back slowly, but
it was a good investment. And to get your point about marketing, I mean, David Lilienthal of the Tennessee Valley Authority, who had a real stake in getting people to use electricity, he used to go around to these small country towns with electrical appliances and actually show people how they could change their lives if they were able to use an electric drill or obviously light bulbs and electric washers, for instance.
Yeah. They would send around people. They call them utilization experts. But they were salesmen. And they pretty quickly discovered that they weren't going to be selling stuff to the farmer as easily as they were to the farmer's wife. She wanted, especially in the South, she wanted a refrigerator to keep her stuff from spoiling. And of course, the women insisted on having indoor running water. That meant you had a pump to pump the water out of the well. And then they wanted a washing machine.
So that's a great example. Okay, what's your second recommendation?
It's to allow people to have more decentralized systems where they feel they have some measure of control. This flies in the face of most of what's been happening.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to be more and more centralized and grids that are more and more intensive and more interconnections. But I think you could get people to reduce their power use if they felt a local connection to it.
Mm.
And if they were plugging in and selling some of the energy back in the form of solar power or wind power that they generated themselves.
So more of a reciprocal relationship to the energy grid.
Yeah, I think so. There was if you think about it historically, through most of human history, people have actually been power producers and consumers.
Right.
It's a kind of historical anomaly that we suddenly don't have to think about that and we just plug something into the wall or we turn a switch on, or turn the ignition on the car and the energy is just supposed to be there.
So when did we become so centralized and hierarchical in our energy?
Well, it comes as an outgrowth of what they sometimes call the networked city, the city which is a series of networks of gas and electricity and water and all sorts of other things that are delivered to the house that you don't have to think about anymore. They just turn the faucet and the water comes. You plug in, the electricity's there. And that comes in the late 19th century to the average person or early 20th century. So it's not historically that long. And through most of history, people have, in fact, had to think about where they would get the power or produce it. And I think we could easily do that again.
Listen, I was talking to a friend who's a psychologist, and he was treating a girl who was addicted to TV. And her parents hooked up an exercise bike that basically powered the TV, and she could not watch television without cycling away. It was a bit of a bargain with the devil there.
Huh.
Yeah.
This puts Skinner in the shade, I tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, at least it was a person, not a rat. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But at least they could choose the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, David Nye is the author of Consuming Power, A Social History of American Energies. Thanks once again, David.
Thank you.
So So what do you think, guys? I actually really liked his notion of this reciprocal relationship. And we have to remember the big energy source in your period, Peter, was muscle power. Yeah, you know, so a lot of humans were putting more energy into the so-called grid than getting it back.
Well, you know, it wasn't in my period. I'm going to risk the 21st century, but I've been reading about dance floors and nightclubs that generate energy.
Only historians read about dance floors, Peter. You know, most normal people go out on them.
Oh, right. That's too threatening. But this notion of reciprocity and a reversible grid, I like that. That's empowering notion.
Well, and that's the funny thing is it fits so well with so many other things going on in our society, empowering the individual.
Yeah, that's makes me think it's a fantasy.
We count on you for optimism.
You know, wouldn't it be great if we all made our own power and contributed to the common good? I mean, what evidence do we have that that's ever worked?
But I do think that David's onto something about enabling people to find ways to reverse the grid. And there are technologies that are available. If you got solar, you can pick up some extra energy. You might plug it in and get credit for it.
Well, that's actually how hybrid cars work.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, believe me, I want it to be true. I thought it was a great interview with him. And, you know, I'd like to focus on the other point, if we could, a little bit, which was not inventing something new, because I thought that was so interesting. That,
focus away, Ed.
Okay. Now it turns out I disagree with that, too. That, in the sense that the idea that we can't invent our way out of it, you know, that seems un-American.
Well, I think he's saying something different, Ed, and that is if consumers become producers and have a stake in new ways of producing or old ways of producing energy, to take your point, that's going to create the conditions for technological innovation.
Yeah, I hope that's right. I guess I was just thinking about another energy form that I happened to read a letter to the editor of the newspaper about whaling. And it turned out that why are whales not extinct? It's because somebody figured out how to get petroleum out of the ground and out of coal and out of shale.
Right.
And consumers preferred that, but they had to have a choice of something to prefer first. So I agree with Dave completely that, you know, the consumers are the ones who are going to make this.
Yeah.
And I also agree that there's a great longing to give back. And if somebody could devise the mechanism by which that's possible, I think it's the
case. So enough of this business of trashing consumers. The future is with consumption. Let's consume our way out of this thing, okay?
I'll go buy some stuff if you will.
This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, historian of 18th century America.
I'm Ed Ayers, historian of 19th century America.
And I'm Brian Ballow, historian of the 20th century. We're talking today about the history of energy consumption in America. Some listeners have already weighed in on our website, and we've invited a few of you to join us on the phone.
First up today, we have Ken calling from Salem, Oregon. Ken, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I had a pretty simple question with a probably difficult answer, but it goes like this. What's the history of pricing for energy in America? How has the price of energy been decided? I mean, sometimes it was price controlled, sometimes it was something else.
Yeah, great question. Ken wants to know why we pay what we pay for energy. And nowadays we think it's political since there's so much public policy involved in this, but Ed and Brian, wouldn't you say that throughout most of American history, 99.9%, that it's the market?
I would say it's the market, Peter, but within that market, I would say there's been a lot of debate over how much control a few big companies can get over that market.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Ed, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's in many ways the big story of the economy of the 19th century or the second half of the 19th century.
Yeah.
It's who's going to control the ability to set those prices. You know, some of the great fortunes in American history were made by attempts of, obviously, of Standard Oil to be able to control the price by controlling the mechanism by which the oil is produced and distributed.
Yeah. The robber barons, the oil guys, gave Americans cheap fuel, but they threatened to control, to monopolize the supply in a way that seemed very scary to Americans,
yeah,
looking to the future.
So what we're saying is it's primarily the market, and within the market, it's how much control a few large companies are going to get. But here's the wild card. At least starting in the late 19th century and increasing in the 20th century, there's the growing possibility of the state, primarily the federal government, providing an alternative to the market. And it happens in two ways. One is the construction of these gigantic dams for hydroelectric power.
And that was by the government.
And that was by the government. And then the threat of the government owning nuclear power plants to generate a lot of energy. So there is this, I think the answer is still the market, but there are lots of ways of tempering that market. In fact, one of the key figures here, a man named David Lilienthal, who ran the Tennessee Valley Authority during the 1930s, he talked explicitly about a yardstick, that the government would provide a yardstick. And if prices got too high on that yardstick, that the government would start producing energy directly. And that always had a very sobering effect on the price of energy.
So what we're seeing is that this is an awesome question. Now, I'd like to hear more about what sparked it.
What sparked it for me was that that's the area I work in. I'm a state regulator.
Cool.
All right.
So tell us
You're
all the ways we're wrong.
You're wielding the yardstick. Huh?
So tell us all the ways we're wrong now.
It's interesting that you're exactly right. That's the first thing I learned when
you can leave now, Ken.
I learned that that was our job, to balance off the needs of that private company with the needs of its customers. And once the needs of the company got too extreme, then something had to be done.
Oh, you've made my week, Ken.
So, yeah, it's a perfect example of what you said.
Well, what about the trade-offs? You said you're from Oregon?
Uh-huh, right.
So you've got a lot of hydroelectric out there, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah, about 60% of our electricity comes from hydro.
Right. So what kind of trade-offs are you facing in terms of getting energy from hydroelectric? I know that a lot of environmentalists are now questioning what these dams do to our ecosystems.
Yeah,
and certainly
starting to tear down dams.
Yeah. Are you in the midst of all those controversies?
Well, one of the things I can tell you is that it's pretty difficult to build any new dams, and a lot of the old ones, as they get older, are not being replaced, and they're not being replaced for exactly those reasons.
So capacity is going to go down.
It's the same in the history profession, Ken.
Ken, thanks a lot. Enjoy talking with you.
No problem, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, I wrote a little bit about when electricity first came to the American South in the 1890s, and that the people were running power lines, you know, just from one tree to another. And one guy writes in his diary, he says, I was out walking today and I saw an electric light, and I just was struck by how beautiful it was. And people must have thought I was an idiot just standing there staring at this electric light.
Yeah.
And it makes you realize how fast that came. So, I mean, I think you'd have to say that one of the great success stories of the 19th century is how democratized access to these new forms of energy became, so that people really could imagine electric vacuum cleaner if you were just a middle-class family. Or, you know, instead of having to heat up an iron in a stove, that you could actually do that. And ironically, the democratization of energy is one of the things that spelled the death knell of servants.
Yeah, and you know, Ed, it's even more incredible than you make it out to be. Which is, if you think of the economics of either providing energy to the masses or providing something like the telephone to the masses, they don't work. It costs these companies. These companies initially don't want to extend service, because they want to capture a really dense population in a very small area, because they got to build all this infrastructure.
Yeah.
So we take that democratization for granted, right? That's a story of America. But when you think of the economics of it, it's more remarkable than you can even imagine, because somehow we managed to take a technology that was really aimed at the elites. I know more about telephone extension than electricity, but they envision this as, you know, the business community all within eight blocks of each other. And to extend that out to the rural South went against every fundamental economic law.
I think that's great, Brian. I'd like to add another darker dimension to it. That is, as soon as aggressive consumers get these new appliances and energy to run them, there's a corresponding fear of new dependencies that comes with the new things that we have. That is, the robber barons, the oil guys, gave Americans cheap fuel, but they threatened to control, to monopolize the supply in a way that seemed very scary to Americans looking to the future.
Yeah.
I guess I was struck recently when oil prices went so high and how quickly the infrastructure built around the assumption of that. I'm thinking about SUVs and the big three auto companies, how quickly that could dissolve.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that across American history. Don't you think that, you know, that what looks like a monopoly and certain to endure forever can break apart? I'd be curious to ask Brian in particular, give me another example of disruptive change of the sort that we've seen recently along these lines.
Well, you know, certainly moving from the infrastructure of, let's say, horses and streetcars, which are very much, you know, traction companies of the late 19th, the end of your period and the beginning of my period. I mean, within 15 years, really, you have a takeover by the automobile. And it just changes the entire infrastructure and the very look of cities.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, Brian, those same horses that you were talking about that were replaced by cars in the beginning of the 20th century, well, they had helped shape the landscape in the early years of the 19th century. You know, I think a lot of people probably have this idea that the 18th century was the real heyday, as it were, of horses in America. And yes, it was in a sense. But massive numbers of horses strapped to things like carriages or plows, that really didn't come until later.
It's hard to use horses pulling wheeled vehicles without roads. It's incredibly slow. It's incredibly inefficient.
That's Ann Norton Green, a historian at the University of Pennsylvania, who's just published a new book about the history of horsepower in the 19th century.
So you start seeing a lot of road construction in the early 19th century. You also, of course, have the construction of canals. They're all animal powered.
Right, they're pulling those canal boats. Wow.
Because you could pull huge canal boats using, one or two or, four horses or mules. So you see, you reshape the landscape through these physical constructions. And, of course, then that shapes settlement patterns and agricultural patterns as well.
Now, Peter, let me get this straight. She's saying that 19th century America grew up around horses? But I thought the 19th century was the age of steam, the iron horse. And I'm the 19th century guy here. What's going on?
Ed, don't get all steamed up. It was the age of steam.
Oh, okay.
But it was also the age of horses, okay? According to Ann Green, the two went hand in hand or hoof and mouth or something like that. Steam power, she says, led to the growth of cities. You got that?
Yep.
But those same cities couldn't function without horses. And so horses weren't replaced by steam. Steam actually gave new life to the horse population.
Yeah, because those cities were really big. So
yeah,
you needed
big.
A ton of horses.
The horse population skyrocketed in the 19th century, especially in places with a lot of trains. Of course, where there are horses, there is also horse. Each one of these horses produced 35 pounds of poo-poo a day. And so that is the whole reason for progressivism, okay? Reform.
Finally, we
explained
that.
You kids out there,
God, for your exams, this is
going to be the question. Explain progressivism, and it's going to be horse doo-doo, okay? Because that's dirty, and public health is a big thing. It's the whole thrust of reform to make cities safer places. So the big reform effort, imagine this. Horse-less carriage, a carriage without horses.
It'll never work.
That's the great dream, and that's going to make the world a better place. So let's listen to Ann Green again.
I think one of the problems is that we have this idea about progress, that we've linked to certain things, and that's one of our energy problems, if you will, is that we don't always think about the way that energies and technologies actually complement each other, which is where steam engines come in.
Okay.
Steam engines really make it possible to use horses economically in a lot of ways, because steam engines can't do it by themselves. At least 19th century steam engines can't.
Uh-huh.
They're large, they're cumbersome, they blow up. And when it comes to steam-powered transportation, of course, they're confined to their rails. They can only go where the rails go,
mm-hmm.
which leaves a lot of turf uncovered,
yeah.
like where most people live.
Exactly, right, right.
So steam, you know, increases the volume of traffic, but without some complementary form of transportation that's a lot more flexible,
yeah.
all you're doing is stacking stuff up in one place.
Yeah, and this image to me of the city that you're describing, in which we have steam that enables long-distance travel, and we have then a complementary development of the use of horses for local delivery and
mm-hmm.
transport and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and all that traffic, all the traffic jams that are going to result. And we haven't even talked about horse doo-doo.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's
amazing how quickly people go to that question.
Yeah, let's just get into it.
Well, horses are like any machine. You know, there's input and mm-hmm. there's output.
Right.
And so if you think about the input and output of cars and, you know, what some of the health implications have been
right.
of the internal combustion engine, it's a different form. It's a different form of waste. And that, in fact, has been one of the problems with regulating the pollution yeah. from internal combustion is that it's gaseous and it moves. And so it often very nicely moves across the political boundary and becomes somebody else's problem.
Right. And that strikes me as a really important point because, mm-hmm. in a way, the problems of pollution that you're talking about in the late 19th century are internal. People pay the costs directly in their daily lives. Modern forms of energy consumption and the modern transportation infrastructure externalizes
mm-hmm.
some of those problems so that we can imagine that, oh, the city is safe and clean. But meanwhile, the world is going down the toilet
mm-hmm.
because of global warming.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at the end of the 19th century and of the 20th, you see energy starts becoming invisible and removed.
Yeah.
People are able to hide or mask
yeah.
both energy and work in a lot of ways. And I think electricity has a lot to do with the move away from horsepower, actually. Not so much that electricity replaced horses, but it introduced people to an incredibly painless form of energy use
right.
and an incredibly convenient form of energy use. People often in audiences will say to me, well, but horses were terribly inefficient. And I said, well, not really. As engines, they are about as efficient as an internal combustion machine. You know, their energy production happens in a different time frame, but time is not really, in terms of energy efficiency, time isn't really a factor. Time is a cultural factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we like things done quickly and easily. So when we say things are efficient, we really mean convenient,
mm-hmm.
that they don't require us to do a lot of immediate work.
Right.
Now, you know, we'd spend a lot of money on the different ways we consume energy, but we don't experience it quite as immediately or directly.
Ann Norton Green teaches history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America.
Ann, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Boy, Peter, there's a lot in that interview. I mean, I really want to pick up on this notion of what economists would call negative externalities
right, right.
and how they get distributed mm-hmm. to places far away, and to explain what negative externalities are. These are kind of the horse droppings
yeah.
of modern technology, and how rather than falling right behind the horse,
mm-hmm.
they now blow over states far away and even contribute to global warming.
Yeah.
Now, on a less global scale, what we have seen in the 20th century, along another great point that your guest made, was how the invisible nature of production of energy. Well, it's not so invisible to the people who are living in the communities where it's being produced.
That's a really an interesting point, Brian. It's a sort of a spatial equivalent of the division of labor.
Exactly.
You know, which is the genius of the modern market economy, is that people do different things. Well, different places have different functions in an interdependent economy. And some places have the function of being, well, waste repositories, on being energy producers with the concomitant waste that go along with it.
But ironically, it's often urban people who have their energy produced invisibly in faraway places that are much more concerned about the environment than the people who are actually living where that energy is actually being produced these
days. Because it's their living.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that connection to jobs.
It's the privilege of privileged people to not have to live on a daily way with
right.
these things. And these are the people then who identify in a global cosmopolitan sense with the meta problem, with the problem on a global scale.
Well, how about the horses? You know, she was talking about the horses.
It was about horses, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Are the horses today strike me as, you know, conspicuous consumption of energy?
Yeah, if they don't do anything, that's right. But that I think Anne Greenwood suggests maybe once we rethink our relationship to energy production and consumption, we could find new uses for old forms of energy production.
Hey, Peter, you wouldn't happen to be thinking about, say, two-wheeled form of energy production.
Well, listen, let's not get personal about this, Brian. You know, some of us are saving Gaia, spaceship Earth, by riding our bicycles around. Some of us are commuting from great distances in motor vehicles.
Well, I'm going to drive my car to the next break, Peter. When we get back, we'll consider a fuel that causes a lot of headaches, literally, at least when it's not available, and we'll take more of your calls.
Folk, don't worry about energy crisis, because Standard Oil, Shell, Gulf, Mobil, Texaco, Amoco, Esso, Sunoco, Exxon, Nixon, Standard Oil, General Motors, Chrysler, George Wallace, and Ford is not the backbone of America. The backbone of America is a mule and cotton. If it had not been for mule and cotton, none of us would be here today. And our forepants did not use horses because a horse eat too much. You can feed six mules for what you...